This is the Coin Market Recap Podcast with Connor Sefton.
Hello to you and welcome to a very special edition of the show. You join us on one of the most significant and most dramatic weeks in Bitcoin's history. On Tuesday, El Salvador became the first country in the world to accept Bitcoin as legal tender. But hours later, the crypto market suffered one of the most brutal crashes of 2021 so far, with almost $10,000 wiped from Bitcoin's price. This isn't a big budget new theme tune, by the way. It's El Salvador's national anthem. We've got a packed show for you. We'll be talking to a crypto enthusiast on the ground to find out what this means for El Salvador. And following widespread protests, a critic of the country's move is also going to be joining us. Plus, CoinMarketCap's Molly Jane Zuckerman will be here to give us her take on this week's drama and discuss why Kim Kardashian has annoyed regulators in the UK. Blockchain engineer David Myhall will explain why hundreds of millions of dollars worth of Ether are being destroyed forever. And we'll get an update on the cutting-edge city that the RMB star Akon is building from a reporter who made a shocking discovery when he visited its location. But first, let's take a look at how the crypto market is performing. Drumroll, please.
Bitcoin is down.
That's right, Bitcoin is down. The world's biggest cryptocurrency has fallen by about 5% over the past 7 days. But that isn't an accurate measure of how crazy the markets have been this week. Let's go back to Tuesday, September the 7th. That was the day El Salvador officially embraced Bitcoin as legal tender, giving it the same status as the US dollar. Things looked incredibly promising at first. Bitcoin was trading at about $52,853. That's the highest price seen in 4 months. But it didn't last, and if you go on the CoinMarketCap website, Bitcoin's charts look like one of the world's scariest roller coasters. In just 12 hours, Bitcoin fell by 18%, taking it as low as $43,285. Now, prices have since rebounded, but there's little doubt that this was a baptism of fire for people in El Salvador who are using Bitcoin for the very first time. At one point, more than $400 billion was wiped off the total market cap of all cryptocurrencies combined. And spur a thought for Michael Saylor, the CEO of MicroStrategy. His company owns more than 105,000 Bitcoin, and on Tuesday alone, the value of this investment fell by $660 million. So, let's return to El Salvador now. It's fair to say that the country had a pretty bumpy start as it tried to introduce Bitcoin to the masses. El Salvador has created an official crypto wallet that the population of about 6.5 million people can use. It's called Chivo, a slang term that's used to describe something cool. Unfortunately, the app was anything but cool on Tuesday morning. To begin with, it wasn't available on Apple's App Store or Google Play, meaning it was difficult to download for anyone with an iPhone or an Android device. Server capacity issues meant that some people were unable to register for an account, making it difficult for those trying to claim the reward of $30 in Bitcoin that they were promised. The wallet ended up being taken offline for a few hours while these problems were resolved. One thing that's been especially surreal has been seeing Twitter videos of Bitcoin being used in major stores. McDonald's, Starbucks, and Pizza Hut are among the big brands that now accept Bitcoin payments, but only in El Salvador. One crypto journalist posted a picture of what looked like a delicious breakfast he bought using crypto, settling the bill with a QR code. But there have been hurdles. Reports suggest that some retailers there, including Walmart, are yet to support Bitcoin transactions. And while concerned Salvadorans have been told that the use of Bitcoin is entirely optional, it isn't the same for businesses. One government official has warned it's mandatory for merchants to accept Bitcoin, and there could be consequences if they don't. There had been a big campaign encouraging people around the world to buy $30 worth of Bitcoin on September the 7th, the same amount people in El Salvador were receiving for free. Despite a Twitter poll suggesting that 75,000 people were prepared to do this, it didn't stop Bitcoin's value from falling through the floor. El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, was also keen to put a brave face on things. After Bitcoin crashed, he announced that the country was buying the dip and snapping up another 150 Bitcoin. That takes the total owned by El Salvador to 550 Bitcoin. Well, there's been a lot of negative headlines about El Salvador this week, but crypto enthusiasts in the country believe the move to accept Bitcoin as legal tender could change lives. CNBC journalist Mackenzie Sigalos pointed out on Twitter that it currently costs $3.24 to send $10 from Canada to El Salvador using Western Union's app, with a waiting time of 3 days. But using the new crypto tools introduced this week, the costs could fall to as little as 10 cents with funds sent instantly. President Nayib Bukele has estimated that the likes of Western Union and MoneyGram will now miss out on $400 million a year in commission. This would mean that people who are in poverty end up having more money in their pockets. There could also be safety benefits, as people receiving money from their loved ones abroad will no longer have to go to a physical location to pick up their cash. Some also believe that El Salvador could become a crucial destination for the crypto industry, bringing investment and opportunities to one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere. Well, El Salvador's crypto community was keen to celebrate on Tuesday night as the first day of a new beginning drew to a close. A crowd gathered at Bitcoin Beach in El Zonte, one of the first places in the country to embrace Bitcoin fully. A party was also held in the capital San Salvador, and inevitably, it was oversubscribed. Well, crypto enthusiast Alexandra Dimitri was one of those who was at that party, and she joins me now from El Salvador. Hi, Alexandra. How are you doing?
Hi, Connor. I'm great. How are you doing?
Very well. Thank you for asking. And thank you very much for being here. So, first question, have you used Bitcoin to buy anything yet?
I have not.
Kidding?
I have not. We're in the middle of moving house right now. So, and I can just tell you from the perspective of someone who, my partner is Salvadoran, who comes from poor community. He's on the national surf team, former surf champion of the country. And he tried to download the app yesterday just to see, and had major technical difficulties, as many people did. So, you know, obviously there are other wallets, there are other ways to use Lightning Network to purchase things. There is a commission if you don't use the Chivo app now. So, but no, I haven't used it yet. And from what I've heard, yesterday, mostly a lot of people run into issues trying to use the app itself. Big companies, like I saw some receipts from Starbucks, from McDonald's, companies that have the infrastructure in place to put this through. But at other smaller merchants, they had problems, and the wallet itself had problems.
So, anecdotally, then, how easy does the process of paying with Bitcoin seem to be compared with using dollars?
Not easy. I mean, not for the average Salvadoran. We're talking about a highly uneducated country, which with massive, I don't know the exact percentage, illiteracy, 70% don't have a bank account. So, and that was a conversation I had at the first Bitcoin dinner several months ago when this initiative was announced. A lot of international folk came in and, you know, crypto enthusiasts, and they had these big ideas. And I've been here since 2015 on and off. And I've sort of, you know, I have a Wall Street background, but I've also been amongst the locals. And I told them flat out that it needs to be, you know, the UX UI of anything they do needs to be super, super, super simple. So, because otherwise people don't understand it. Even educated people don't understand it worldwide, right? My mom's a doctor in the U.S. She doesn't understand it. You know, to have someone with a fourth grade education maybe try to understand it, it has to be easy. And it's not quite there yet. So there's mistrust in people. There's mistrust in things that, you know, you don't understand, obviously. So I would say the average Salvadoran, it's going to be a process onboarding.
I'm sensing a kind of a divide here, Alexandra, because you yourself describe yourself as a crypto enthusiast, but you do know that there are problems here. So
Give us a sense of what the atmosphere was like at that party last night. How is the crypto community feeling? Was the mood dampened by Tuesday's crash?
No, actually not at all. It was funny. I was speaking to a journalist from Bitcoin Magazine and just said something about the markets, and he replied, "Oh, I don't even watch the markets." So, okay. Mm-hmm. No, it wasn't at all. I think, obviously, the atmosphere was excitement, a lot of jubilation. It was a big deal, right? But I also believe, and I was happy to see this, is that people, especially the international folk, have managed their expectations better of how this is going to play out. Because at that first dinner, I was basically sitting there explaining to everybody, except for one guy who came from Senegal, who was actually one of the organizers of last night's event, who came from another third world country, that the things that they're talking about just have to be simple. You can't just throw this at a population like this, you know. And this was rolled out very quickly. And, you know, I mean, you have people who are developers and whatnot yesterday. They're moving things in between custodial, non-custodial wallet, you know, the Shivo app and other wallet. But this isn't something that most people can do. Mm-hmm. So, and I think people are realizing that, you know. And so I was happy to see that. Because this, you know, I think Bitcoin could be a great thing for El Salvador, especially obviously with remittances being a huge thing here. You know, love to see Western Union get wiped out.
You know, it's a really interesting point that you're raising here, and I'm really keen to get a sense of how significant that this is for people living in El Salvador. And I was involved in a Twitter Spaces conversation on Tuesday with people who were in El Salvador. And I was making the point that it could be rather difficult for certain people, especially people who are older, to use the Chivo wallet and to make the most of what Bitcoin offers. And not many people agreed with that. There was one person who said, you know, my mother, she makes really, complicated foods, and making those foods is so much harder than it is using a Bitcoin wallet. I wasn't really sold on that. I kind of think she's probably mastered this food over years and years and years.
And, right.
Just learning how to use a Bitcoin wallet isn't necessarily something that can happen overnight. So ultimately, my question is, what does this mean for everyday consumers? Are we going to see this picked up in a meaningful way among Salvadoran consumers?
I think time will tell. It's not going to be a quick overnight process by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, obviously, this was rolled out very quickly, to the surprise of the whole world and the excitement of the whole world.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, you know, again, I mean, back to the education factor is, you know, you're dealing with a highly uneducated population. So, and they don't even understand what Bitcoin is, a lot of them, you know, to begin with. And, you know, my partner, who teaches surf lessons sometimes, you know, he has the Bitcoin Beach app, and that actually lets you hold Bitcoin, right? And he asked me, he's like, "Wait, I got paid $20. Why is it 19 now?" It's just, so... Mm-hmm. To give you an idea, right? And so there needs to be more education. There needs, you know, Bukele has had several cadenas, some sort of State of the Union type, you know, mini addresses, if you will, you know, kind of laying things out. But there really hasn't been a massive education initiative, and I think there needs to be. How that will look, I don't know. But on a national level, that's going to need to happen for more people to adopt it and to use it.
You're absolutely right. I completely agree with you. I think that the other challenge is for those who did manage to get their head around how everything's working, and those who managed to download the wallet. And like you say, there was a research from a local university that said 9 in 10 people in El Salvador don't understand how Bitcoin works. But for those who did get to use Bitcoin on Tuesday, do you think that the crash in prices affected confidence and made people feel less certain about embracing Bitcoin?
It didn't seem to be. I mean, that didn't seem to be the mood that I got from the people that, you know, but again, these people are mostly developers, the ones who are really obviously on top of it and the first adopters, right? So they're more interested in, you know, it's kind of like going to a casino and just playing the game to see how it plays out, even though you know how the odds are. I mean, me personally, coming from a finance background, you know, I'm bullish on Bitcoin, so I wouldn't spend my Bitcoin to buy a sandwich, personally. Mm-hmm. You know, like I would hold on to it.
Well, you touch on a really good point here, because, you know, like you've said, big benefit that's been touted with Bitcoin is that it can reduce the cost of remittances. Costs are very high in El Salvador. But that's a real question about the practicality of using crypto for everyday purchases. And the story that always springs to mind is Bitcoin Pizza Guy, who spent 10,000 Bitcoin on two pizza pies in 2010. And today, you know, they're probably worth more than $450 million. And so, yeah. And so you've got these consumers and who are now being encouraged to use their Bitcoin at Starbucks and at Pizza Hut and at McDonald's. But is there not a worry that the Bitcoin that they use to buy that coffee or that pizza today could be worth much, much more in the future?
Of course, and I think even people who can't allocate that properly understand that. So, mm-hmm. you know, so again, there's that reluctance. I mean, really though, the way this wallet works is that, you know, you never really hold Bitcoin unless you mm-hmm. want to, right? Mm-hmm. And the government, you know, catches that upside. Is, mm-hmm. you know, that's their play in this, which obviously they made a huge investment, bought a ton of Bitcoin, etc. But, you know, it's if I buy something that costs a dollar from you, you know, I'm paying a dollar, you get a dollar, and we theoretically would never have to actually have any Bitcoin. It would just go through the app.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. you know, but yeah, I mean, of course, that's something that people are concerned about. They already, mm-hmm. you know, like, it wasn't so long ago that the dollar was imposed upon them, right? And now there's Bitcoin, and there's also talk of a potential national cryptocurrency that, you know, so people's heads are spinning a little bit.
And on Twitter Spaces on Tuesday night, actually, someone made the point to me. They were saying that when the dollar was brought in 20 years ago, one of the most common effects of that was that people ended up paying more for their everyday items than they would normally because of the impact of introducing a new currency had. They were saying like everything cost a dollar. And so, whereas in comparison, if they were using the local currency that had been in force before, the actual cost of that would have been, you know, far less than a dollar.
Sure. I mean, but that being said, you know, there have been issues with, you know, huge inflationary issues here because it is dollarized. And for, you know, the U.S. has been printing money. And as U.S. citizens, you know, we've been receiving stimulus checks and other benefits, but those aren't received by other countries that use the U.S. dollar as currency, right? So there have been inflationary issues in places like here in Ecuador, which also use the dollar. So, you know, I mean, I definitely see why Bukele wants to get away from the dollar. There's no question. Is this the right way about it? We'll see.
Oh, yeah. Now, on the day that this happened, the Financial Times said that what El Salvador is doing, this is the editorial board, they described it as a dangerous experiment that will fail and cause ordinary people to suffer. Now, in your view, is this doom-mongering or is this a legitimate concern?
I think that's a little bit doom-monger. But mm-hmm. it could go either way, you know? I mean, Bukele has been very full throttle in his presidency. He's done a lot. There are people who agree. There are people who disagree. you know, people are already suffering here. So it's... Mm-hmm. You know, but it's an experiment. Would it ever be played out in a first world country? No, because no first world country is going to say, hey, okay, we're going to give up the euro or whatever, right? Or the mm-hmm. British pound and adopt Bitcoin, or not give it up, but, you know, adopt Bitcoin and completely tinker with our economy. Like, you sort of have to do it in a third world country. I don't see how much worse it can get, to be honest with you. Like, there's a lot of poverty here. There's some money, but there's a lot of poverty. A lot of people who, you know, my partner grew up in a tin hut. Parts of his neighborhood have no electricity. Local surfers, by his break, probably half of them can't read. So, you know, the poverty's real already.
Given everything we talked about, and like we said, you know, you're a crypto enthusiast here. So what can Bitcoin bring to El Salvador then?
I really think remittances are the biggest space where it can make a big impact. I mean, just having sent, mm-hmm. you know, especially during the pandemic, sent money to friends and family and whatnot down here, it's ridiculous, the fees, you know, and then they have to mm-hmm. go to the Western Union, which isn't always close to where they are, you know, and it's not like they can just call an Uber if they're in a rural area, right? They've got to take, like, I don't know how many buses, possibly through gang territory, yada, yada, yada. So I think that's the best use case. I think for everyday transactions, me personally, like I said, like as someone who buys, you know, buys the dips, if you will, and as an investor, I just wouldn't spend it. I would hang on to it because I believe it's going higher. But, you know, I don't think most people here are thinking that way. There just needs to be more education and, you know, and a more clear kind of layout of what, you know, what the end game is here, really, because Bukele was kind of like, okay, we're doing this, and without much of a why, right, as far as explaining to the populace. And I think that's why a lot of people globally are, you know, keeping an eye on things and a little bit concerned, as you know, mentioned in the Financial Times.
Like you said, exactly like you said before, 70% of Salvadoran adults don't have a bank account. And I guess that one potential worry is that they might not have the technology or the technical skills to make the most out of crypto.
No, I mean, a lot of them don't have smartphones, right? So that just wipes out some. Like, I don't know what the percentage is, but a lot of them don't. So again, you know, I mean, but those who do have smartphones, like, it just has to be made very, very easy. And as of yet, it's not. But that's to be expected, right? You can't expect it to be perfect on day one of something that was announced a couple of months ago. This is a huge, huge project. A lot of people working on it. And, you know, hopefully the good will prevail. It's really hard to predict how this is going to look 6 months, 6 years, you know, from now.
And if you were to make a prediction, where will we be 6 months or 6 years from now?
I think 6 months will be not so different from today unless the administration really starts educating people, you know, or someone does, you know, some organization. But really, I feel like, you know, it's up to the government to do it, right, because they impose this law. So they should, you know, teach people about it more so that they will actually use it. Because unless that happens, I don't see a whole lot of movement in the next 6 months. You know, again, if things are made simple and if, you know, the technology is stable, because yesterday the app wasn't even working for like half the day, or the wallet rather, the Chivo wallet. So, you know, that's something too. Like if everything stays stable, you know, I think, again, you know, remittances would be a great case outcome. I don't really see a lot of people wanting, you know, not even, you know, for my reasons of, okay, I think Bitcoin's going to go up, but they prefer having cold, hard cash in their hands, something they can see and feel.
Alexandra Dumitru, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me, Connor. I really appreciate it.
Well, let's get another view on what's happening in El Salvador now. David Gerard is a journalist and author who has written books about Facebook's controversial Libra project, now known as Diem, and he's also written Attack of the 50-Foot Blockchain. A cursory glance of his Twitter page makes it clear that he thinks making Bitcoin legal tender is a bad idea. Thanks for joining us, David. How would you describe how Bitcoin Day went?
It did not go well. Bitcoin is not popular, and the Chivo wallet went badly. And so, put it this way, it's at the stage where thousands of people marched in the streets and were setting fire to things. This is usually not considered going very well. Basically, what happened was they were determined to put in the Bitcoin project, and they went, right, we're just going to do it. Big bang, push it through. Because that's President Bukele's style in El Salvador. He's a sort of populist leader. He's very popular. He is actually very popular. He does this by spending lots of public money on services. The trouble is that Salvador is effectively a hard currency country because their currency is the US dollar. So the government can't print more. They have to pay all their bills. Mm-hmm. So he has to get new dollars from somewhere. So we're thinking that's what he was doing to get what he thought when he was putting the Bitcoin project into place. But he's a very gung-ho, just-do-it kind of guy. So he went, right, we'll just put this into place. He ignored literally everyone saying it's a bit more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. And then the one thing we knew would not happen on Tuesday was a smoothly working system that did everything advertised for it. Mm-hmm. That was not on the cards. The Chivo wallet app was launched. No one had had access to it beforehand. They didn't like run tests or pilot programs or whatever. They launched it at 2 a.m. It was available on the app stores in El Salvador time. 3 a.m. it had fallen over. Mm-hmm. Apparently, the image servers were overloaded. Now, everyone's asleep at 3 a.m., so this sounds doesn't sound like a well-architected system. It came back about 6 hours later. They were then slowly releasing it to the app stores. Meanwhile, people were demonstrating in the streets. Now, the main objection of the populace to the Bitcoin law, they think Bitcoin is silly. They don't like a lot of basic things about it. It's very volatile, and it doesn't work well as sort of currency. But they really objected to the fact that Bitcoin was being made compulsory.
Yes.
Like, you have to accept Bitcoin. That has been the major point of contention. And this is interesting. Even crypto fans in El Salvador, and there's a lot of crypto fans in El Salvador. You know, it's a poor country, but it's got a certain populace of techies who really know their stuff, are very capable. And they said, look, this is bad. It's making outreach impossible because people hate this thing already. There was things like 2 days before Bitcoin Day, a fellow called Mario Yomez, who he's a local techie startup guy. He has also been a staunch critic of the Bitcoin initiative. Most of his objection is actually that it's compulsory. I mean, sure, cryptocurrency, maybe, but making it compulsory is just not going to work. And he gave detailed technical reasons as to why. So then they arrested him without a charge and held him and grabbed his phones, which they still have. And he only just got back online yesterday with a video telling people to continue to network and speak up. So that's very, it's been very, very contentious. It's like they're really upsetting people a lot.
Yes. And you were mentioning the fact that it's been made mandatory, especially for retailers. They've been told they must accept it as a payment method or they could face consequences. Some have pointed out that this goes against the principles of Bitcoin. The problem is, if it isn't mandatory for retailers to accept it, people who may want to use Bitcoin may not be able to do so.
So making it mandatory really did not go down well with anyone. I mean, a lot of Bitcoiners have objected to this as well. But the actual system is a payment system called Chivo, which is a word meaning goat, and it's local slang for cool. So the thing is that it's basically a – effectively, it is the level two, the layer two of the system sort of thing, running over Bitcoin backed by exchanges like BitGo and Bitso, and I think Coinbase is in there somewhere. Where they basically, it's a payment system. It's like PayPal, you know, or like if Coinbase was a payment system. You know, you have a balance in dollars and a balance in bitcoins. Those are held by them as liabilities to you. It's a custodial wallet, and you pay for things with it. That's simple enough. But basically, it's all just the Chivo proprietary system. Supposedly, you can use bitcoins separately. There's some Lightning Network nodes over there, but that's not part of Chivo, at least not at the present stage. So it's all a bit of a mess, and it doesn't work very well because they did it as a great big bang system instead of with planning and testing.
Yeah, and I read an interview where you expressed concerns that the Chivo app could be could allow the Salvadoran government to effectively create Bitcoin out of thin air. How would that work?
Well, the create database entries, create pseudo dollars in the application. I mean, this isn't just my surmise. This is a common worry amongst Salvadorans because they don't trust the financial probity of their own government under pressure. So this is a thing people are worried about, that at some point they will just create dollars in the app that aren't actually dollars. The reasons for this is because the president really needs dollars to pay his bills, like actual dollars. For instance, they really want to grab the remittance market because a quarter of Salvador's GDP is remittances from Salvadorans in the US. People who go to the US, work high-paying jobs, send money home. That's a huge amount of money. And he really wants to get his hands on those dollars and give the people in El Salvador quote, dollars, unquote, inside the app, but not physical dollars. Chivo ATMs have been running out of cash already. Stuff like that. It's a system like this will make or break on the little details. And if you make it mandatory, it had better work perfectly out the box. And also it helps if you're not, like, arresting people who object to it.
Yes, definitely. And you did mention remittances there. And of course, crypto enthusiasts inside and outside of El Salvador say that the big benefit of embracing Bitcoin is that it can help reduce the cost of remittances, which at the moment is very high for people who are sending money back. Assuming that we had systems that were working perfectly, could Bitcoin and could the systems that are being created help reduce the cost of remittances, do you think?
Not in this case. Mm-hmm. The usual, the figures of 10 to 20% for remittances, the highest figures in the world are sending remittances to sub-Saharan Africa, for example, really out-of-the-way places, mm-hmm. Where what you're paying Western Union for is not the transmission, it's that last mile and maintaining infrastructure in the local area and getting mm-hmm. cash to them and so forth, which is expensive. For El Salvador, the currency is US dollars. You don't even have a currency conversion step. It's a high-volume corridor with multiple competitors, so percentage commissions are actually quite low. The mm-hmm. attraction with Chivo is the government has said there will be no fees inside Chivo. So the app will be available internationally. The idea is that someone in the US installs Chivo, they put their actual dollars into Chivo, those show up at the Salvador end and are as dollars inside Chivo. Mm-hmm. And the government is subsidizing the fees for this. There's like a budget item for it and everything. Mm-hmm. So they're basically making that an artificially zero cost channel, which, fine, you know. I mean, something like Chivo, you can see it being of a useful thing, but forcing it on people is not going down well, and the fact that it's clunky and largely doesn't work. The Know mm-hmm. Your Customer stuff doesn't work at all, by the way. Yes. This has been coming out. You can literally put up a photocopy of any El Salvador national ID card, because that solves a lot of the banking, the unbanked problem. They have national ID. You can get a bank account mm-hmm. with just a national ID card. And any photo of anything whatsoever that might look a bit like a face and a national ID number, and you can create a Chivo wallet with 30 pseudo dollars in it. And a lot of people are discovering they've had wallets created in their name already. Mm-hmm. Like the KYC system does not actually check things, it seems. That's yes. a major disaster, which I understand they're busy working on and trying to clean up the consequences of it, because, you know, people are getting quite upset about that.
And speaking of major disasters, many people in El Salvador would have been quite alarmed by Bitcoin's crash on Tuesday. What do you think would happen if Bitcoin fell back to the levels that we saw last year, like below $20,000, for example? I mean, you must think that this could have a really big impact on people who are coming into the ecosystem now when prices are as high as they are. And if Bitcoin retraces, it could affect a lot of people.
I'll tell you, on Tuesday, people watched in real time as their $30 became $25. And that's mm-hmm. a lesson which it really brought home to them, that Bitcoin is volatile, means something. That's mm-hmm. one of the other problems with it as a sort of remittance thing. I mean, I was actually watching the price chart at that time. It was 4 p.m. UK time, mm-hmm. 1500 UTC, when the price on Coinbase dropped like $2,500 literally in a minute. Mm-hmm. And it's like, wow, what just happened? Did someone dump? What happened? And the price went down, burning all the long margin traders, and then bounced back up again, burning all the short margin traders. And then it came out the next day that Coinbase had received a Wells notice from the SEC, mm-hmm. which obviously this is just an amazing coincidence, and it's amazing how these coincidences keep happening. You know, bad news is reflected in the market 8 hours earlier. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the Bitcoin market, I always assume that anything weird like that happening is shenanigans, because it always turns out to be shenanigans. But yeah. But anyway, it's very volatile and it's difficult to deal with. And people who are just trying to live their lives with a stable amount of money they understand, like a dollar, they're not going to deal well with volatility, which is one of crypto's big problems as currency.
Now, is there any prospect, do you think, that El Salvador could end up having to perform a U-turn and abandon Bitcoin if things go badly? And what impact would this have on the crypto market?
So I think that it's quite likely that they will, that mm-hmm. this can't keep going. It's not going to end well. The various service companies, I can't I've been told lots of, I've got lots of Salvador contacts. It's nice, you know, people tell you stuff, but there's a lot of clunky stuff happening in the background. Some of the companies who got the contracts, they got them because they were considered politically right on by the government, and they're not actually good at the job. Mm-hmm. They're not actually experienced at success in payments, and that's not good. Mm-hmm. So we have a system that can't work, can't be stable. There's a $150 million buffer, which the government has set up for the Bitcoin to dollar interface. And the obvious thing, Bitcoin is money that is out of the hard control of governments. Now, that was always done with sincere intentions, but the other sort of person that sort of thing attracts, of course, is crooks. Mm-hmm. And the first thing crooks do is, I've got some dirty Bitcoins from my proceeds of awful crimes. How can I turn them into clean dollars? And it is absolutely certain that they are looking at this and looking for every possible way in, you know, like hack someone's Chivo wallet or create a bunch of wallets with bots, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that $150 million fund will be drained reasonably quickly, in weeks or months, local economists are estimating. This whole thing, it could fall over in a month, it could fall over in 3 months. They could try to keep it going. They could say it was a fabulous success, even if people avoid using it as hard as possible, or it could collapse and Bukele could blame the IMF, George Soros, and the conspiracy of billionaires against him, which is what he blames everything else on.
I just want to talk about things just beyond El Salvador for the rest of this interview, if that's okay, David. And sure. I was reading a Bloomberg feature in which you were featured, and you said, quote, there's a lot of things to object to about crypto. It's full of scams. It rips people off. Proof of work mining is destructive. But my objection has always been the people. Can you expand on that?
So I heard about Bitcoin in 2011, and I thought, right, this is annoying internet libertarian nerds have invented their own form of money.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, I know these people. They, people who think you can invent things from first principles and have them just work as they imagined it without actually knowing anything about the area they're working in.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of thing never works out well. You know, it's the formula for stereotypical Silicon Valley tech bros.
Mm-hmm.
So, unfortunately, what happened with Bitcoin? The very first thing from 2011, when you could first change Bitcoins to money and back reasonably reliably, Mt. Gox and so on, it's like, what was the first thing that happened? You had naive, well-meaning people, very sincere, but who didn't actually know anything about money or the history of finance. And they went, we've got a whole new form of money. Things are different now. This was like a bat signal for scammers.
Mm-hmm.
So you immediately had every scam recapitulated. It's a very instructive thing historically. If you want to do things like go to Bitcoin Talk and look through the altcoin board as it was in 2011 and the sort of things they were posting, you'll see similar sort of schemes and scams and shenanigans that you see in the crypto markets in 2021. Schemes that look very like DeFi, for example, but they all have the essential element. I'm doing a thing. It's very complicated. Don't worry if you don't understand it. We're definitely going to get rich from this. Oh, it's all gone.
Mm-hmm.
obviously, if you are going to dive into crypto markets, caveat emptor big time, you know, there's no one watching out for you. Mm-hmm. And you should realize that you are swimming with sharks. Mm-hmm. But, you know, anyone listening to this will probably understand that. But there's a lot of silly things about Bitcoin. There's a lot of hilarious dumb crooks. There's a lot of horrible frauds. There's a lot of sincere, well-meaning people who ask the right questions, and I just think they've got wrong answers. I've met a lot of really nice people who I like, even if I disagree with them on the value of crypto, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And to this is my last question, and it's a bit of a devil's advocate kind of question. Now, sure. That Bloomberg feature
also noted that you've been predicting crypto's demise for a decade, and you conceded that you've been wrong about Bitcoin.
That's not the case. I haven't actually been predicting its demise.
This is how Bloomberg characterized it, I should say. But you you conceded that you've been wrong about Bitcoin lots. That was a quote from you. And you said that this shows how stupid the market is.
Well, what I actually said, so obviously my actual prediction, and I've said this, is that Bitcoin will be around for decades, because all you need is two fans, a copy of the blockchain, a copy of the software, and they can swap Bitcoins to the heart's content. The question is how much that interacts with the world of actual dollars. That's a different question entirely. When people say Bitcoin will survive, Bitcoin's here to stay, it's sort of an empty statement, because do they mean the present arrangements are here to stay? Because that's obviously not the case. You know, it's endlessly changing.
Yes, and what I was going to ask was, you know, we've now seen a country has Bitcoin as legal tender. The likes of Visa and MasterCard and PayPal are looking into or embracing crypto. Established banks making bullish predictions. Bitcoin's price, it's been fairly resilient. Would there ever be a point where you think that this isn't a market acting stupidly, but that you might just be wrong about crypto?
So we literally know that the crypto market runs on shenanigans. There's that huge unaccounted for pseudo money market fund called Tether, for example, which appears to be backed by squirrels and confetti. We literally know shenanigans go on, and that they are literally the same sort of shenanigans that happened in the unregulated stock trading industries of the 19th century, for example. The sort of stuff that people forget happens because people are so used to a regulated world where you have an SEC and a CFTC and a financial conduct authority and so forth. And they forget what things are like when there are literally no there is literally no regulation. Talk of crypto exchanges trading against their own customers, that sort of thing, to tell their mates to go and burn the shorts or longs today. It's this sort of shenanigans doesn't actually happen that much on real stock exchanges or real commodities exchanges. And it happens all the time on crypto. Like, no one really thinks of the London Stock Exchange is going to try to rug pull you. If you're on a crypto exchange, you have to worry about that all the time.
But shenanigans do happen in regulated environments, though, don't they?
Absolutely, they do. But nothing like on this scale. The crypto markets, they're slowly getting more regulated. And I think that's actually good because, you know, if you want real money, you have to basically work to the rules of expectations of real money. And like, expectations are sometimes harsher than the actual rules. People do not like being scammed or do not like feeling scammed. They get really upset. You know, to some extent, there's going to be always a place for dog eat dog trading markets where you go in and you're on your own and that's the deal. That's absolutely unsuitable for mums and dads and grannies.
Yes.
You know, there's reason. It turns out I was always offended by accredited investor rules when I first heard about them. What? Only the rich are allowed to get rich? That's terribly unfair. But then you look at history and you go, every time these rules are relaxed, mums and dads and grannies get skinned. And that's bad socially. You know, it leads to aggrieved citizens waving torches and pitchforks. And like things like the SEC was established as an attempt to try to save the stock market from really, really upset citizens, you know, and allow it to keep going at all, that sort of thing. A bit of regulation is good for business. Like, we see this over and over. You cannot have a market that is unregulated and has a really bad reputation as being an unregulated market. Partially regulated markets don't quite do it either, you know. Like, Gemini or Coinbase or something might be well-behaved and well-known persons, but Honest Joe's crypto casino and bait shop may not be less so, but they're both in the same market, and the bad exchange sort of contaminates the market for the good exchange.
Well, David Gerrard, I don't think you're going to go out of business scrutinizing the crypto sector anytime soon. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
It's absolutely amazing. I follow that stuff because it is so endlessly fascinating.
It really is. It really is. And I do appreciate you giving us your insight.
Thank you.
This week's crypto headlines.
And joining me now is CoinMarketCap's content czar, Molly Jane Zuckerman. Hello, Molly Jane. How are you?
You're on mute, Molly Jane.
What I said was, good morning. We're recording a bit earlier than usual for me. And I think that that proved it.
So, yes, the microphone stays on. That's normally how these types of things work.
Yeah, I won't touch it anymore. I had to mute it because I was yawning.
Okay, well, no more yawns are allowed for the next 15 minutes at least.
I'll try.
Thank you. So I guess we do have to start. What's your take on what happened with El Salvador on Tuesday, with Bitcoin's price on Tuesday? Terrible Tuesday. Oh, I mean, where do you want to start? Where's your head on this?
So with Bitcoin's price, I can start. I have a personal anecdote and then I have my general understanding of the matter. Mm-hmm. And my general understanding is that Bitcoin goes up when bad things happen in the world. Mm-hmm. So I don't really understand why everyone was convinced that this was going to be some giant price boost for Bitcoin when something mm-hmm. good happened. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, it's kind of like it's the classic buy the rumor, sell the news kind of scenario, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it was, I don't know. I mean, I saw that people, I mean, the El Salvadorians that had gotten their airdropped 30 Bitcoin were having trouble selling it, having trouble moving it. I know there was a social media movement for everyone to buy $30 of Bitcoin in solidarity, but maybe people took advantage of that to sell. I mean, I don't know. And the reason it was personally frustrating to me as someone that lives entirely off of Bitcoin is that once a month I have to pay certain bills, and that day happened to be yesterday. So it couldn't have come at a worse time. And I personally blame El Salvador for that, personally, the country.
I mean, I've got to be honest, Molly Jane, you're braver than I am. I couldn't live entirely off crypto. I mean, I myself, it was payday, and so I get paid in Bitcoin, and it was I thought I'd have a lie-in, and I was paid when it was about $52,000 per Bitcoin, and then by the time I woke up, it had gone down to like $45,000. You're like, oh no.
See, that's my philosophy and the way I have to think about things, considering that all my money is in Bitcoin. And for anyone listening, that is not a lot of money. Like, I should not be a target for anyone out there. You will not like get my millions because they don't exist. Is that I just think so long term. I'm like, in 10 years, like, this is my nest egg. Like, this is going to send my kids to college. And I can't get bogged down by the $10,000 gains and losses over the course of a week, or I would literally go clinically insane, which I think mm-hmm. a lot of people do in this space because they put too much importance to Bitcoin's price movements.
So let's talk about some other news this week then. And Kim Kardashian has been in a bit of bother this week, hasn't she?
She has been, but I don't know. When I saw this, most of the time when people report on this kind of news, there is a charge, if that makes sense. There's like something going on here. And this is more just like a soundbite. Like this is someone saying, don't do this in the future. So I thought it's interesting that they're not actually charging anyone with any sort of unlawful promotion, you know, because in America did that. The SEC has find a lot of celebrities a lot of money for promoting tokens. But in this case, it's a little different. It's more like Kim Kardashian, don't do that. Don't do that.
Yeah,
at all.
Well, you're right. And this was the UK's Financial Conduct Authority. It's a city watchdog in the UK. And Charles Randall, who's the boss, was making a speech, and he noted that Kim Kardashian had promoted Ethereum Max to her 250 million followers on Instagram. He said it might have been the financial promotion with the single biggest audience reach
in history. Now, Ethereum Max is a tiny token. It's like in the 3000s in the rankings. Its price is a fraction of a cent. It's currently down 97% since it hit an all-time high at the end of May. And you're right, Kim Kardashian has not been charged with anything. And technically as well, she added the hashtag of an ad to her Instagram post, so she ticked a box there. But I guess the point is, at least in the UK, the regulator we're talking about actually has no authority to regulate cryptocurrencies. So there's actually very little that they can do about this rather than issue these stern warnings.
Yes, this financial authority can just issue warnings. Mm-hmm. I am curious about the amount of people that were, shall we say, negatively affected by the ad, because if prices of Ethereum Max have fallen by almost 97% since May, it's not like she shilled this coin and then it became the biggest Ponzi scheme that has, you know, made a lot of people millions. I guess I'll make a call out to our listeners. If any of you guys have been personally affected by Ethereum Max, personally victimized by Ethereum Max, you know, tweet at us. I'm curious to hear if this reach actually caused people to make or lose money.
Yeah, and same as well. If you've invested in any cryptocurrency that's been endorsed by a celebrity, get in touch with us. So I'm at Connor Sefton, Molly Jane, you're at Molly J. Zuckerman. It'd be really great to hear from you. It's something that we really should look into more.
Especially because I definitely am influenced by celebrity endorsements of other products. Like, I love George Clooney's tequila. Like, I will buy that.
I like his Nespresso myself.
You know, but would I buy his coin? I don't know. The tequila is good.
And I mean, also the difference, the difficulty as well can be, whereas some celebrities are really quite down the rabbit hole with cryptocurrencies and they know what they're talking about. Mila Kunis, good example. Others might just be getting involved just for the payday and they don't actually know or care about how the digital assets sector works.
Do we think that Kim Kardashian knows that Ethereum Max is not Ethereum?
Do we think that everyday investors know that Ethereum Max is not Ethereum too?
That is the question. That is the question, I think, here, actually, because of the way the coin is named. That's the question. Does anyone know what Ethereum Max is?
Also, like, I know this is, I'm going to answer my own question here because we are in a decentralized world, but I do find it alarming how easy it is for coins to just take Bitcoin's name or take Ethereum's name, especially when they aren't even a hard fork of the project.
Yeah, well, I think that would go down a very slippery copyright law slope that I don't fully understand. But as much as I know about copyright law is that if you own the name for something, you have to show in good faith that you want to keep it. So if anyone makes something that sounds like you, you have to sue them. And there's no one from Bitcoin or from Ethereum that could go around suing all of those projects.
Well, Ethereum's co-founders could, I guess, but you're right about Bitcoin. I mean, there's, you know, Satoshi Nakamoto isn't going to go to court and say, excuse me, you're using my IP.
That would be such a lame way for him to reveal his identity.
Yeah, it really would. It would.
Of all the ways.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And last but by no means least, there's been a bit of a weird story that's now emerged with Coinbase. So they've written a blog post and they've said that the US Securities and Exchange Commission is actually threatening to sue them over the new lending product that they're planning to release.
So yeah, I've heard about this case. I know that they maintain that other companies in this space have a similar lending product. And that they're very frustrated with the SEC's almost like too eager threats without explaining why this product wouldn't actually live up to their standards. Mm-hmm. My personal take on this is that Coinbase should stay out of the lending game because the lending game is so sketchy. It's so sketchy. And even if they're Coinbase and they do everything right and by the rules, it kind of makes me see the company in a different way. I remember a few months ago, I got an email from Coinbase that I truly thought was a scam email saying you can borrow up to, I think, $100,000 from us with crypto.
Why do you say the lending game is sketchy?
I think that the crypto industry is volatile, which I don't think anyone can say I'm wrong there. And I know that yield farming and liquidity pool hopping, et cetera, is a very popular thing. And people do make a lot of money off of it. But I always think that borrowing money and lending money in cryptocurrency is, I think it's dangerous.
What you're saying here, Molly Jane, is kind of striking at the very core of what DeFi is trying to achieve, isn't it? But, you know, Coinbase Lend in particular, this proposed service, which may not now launch until the end of October at the earliest, they were going to offer interest of 4% per annum on USDC, which is a stable coin backed by the US dollar. So not necessarily a volatile asset like, say, Bitcoin or Ether is. And obviously, that's more than what you'd get in interest in a normal bank account. So surely that's all right. That's not too sketchy, is it?
Well, the thing is, so you would earn this interest by lending your crypto to other people. But I just don't trust that if the market doesn't crash, I think the program could crash because everything that happens in the traditional financial space can happen in the crypto space. But big problems in the financial space take a longer time to come to fruition so that people defaulting on their loans happens over a long period of time, a few years, 10 years as a bubble slowly bursts. In crypto, things can happen a lot quicker and people can be left with a lot of money within the span of, as we saw yesterday, like 15 minutes, which is why I think that lending programs are inherently more dangerous and inherently can just cause a lot more problems a lot faster.
And you're absolutely right. And we have seen this actually unfold. I'm thinking of March 2020, and that was when Bitcoin fell by like 50% in the space of 2 days. And the thing is, when you get a crypto loan, you normally, you need to post some collateral. And oftentimes, actually, you need to post more collateral than what the loan itself is actually worth. So in order to get $10,000, you would need to put $10,000 of cryptocurrency in, and then probably in some cases, 50% more. And if the cryptocurrency's value falls below a certain level, your position is liquidated. And that's what's happened with MakerDAO. The price fell so fast that people were having all of their positions just wiped out so quickly, and they couldn't do anything about it because everything happened so fast.
Yeah, and obviously that has happened in the stock market, but it has not happened as often and as quickly, I would argue. So.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. So yeah, we'll just have to see, I guess, what happens with Coinbase. I do take Brian Armstrong's point. He's the exchange's CEO, because he's unhappy because in his eyes, Coinbase is trying to talk to these regulators, trying to get them involved. And his argument is that there's not much clarity for crypto businesses in the US. And he said regulation by litigation should be the last resort for the SEC, not the first.
It is a little frustrating if it is as he says, or as Coinbase says, and they have had open discussions with the SEC for 6 months. And at the end of the 6 months, the SEC says, your plan is a bad idea. And if you do it, I will sue you, but I cannot tell you why. Yeah, that would be frustrating. That would be frustrating. Even if I maybe personally agree with the SEC's assessment, I would be curious to know their reasoning for it, because that could lay the groundwork for other companies in the space that want to launch similar lend products.
Yeah, and it just doesn't bode well, does it, when the SEC's got a message of, you know, our door's open, please talk to us, and this happens. It doesn't really incentivize crypto companies to cooperate with regulators, does it?
No, it doesn't at all. I don't think it does at all. I think this is an example of someone trying and people thinking, oh, if this works, I'll also try. Now, I don't imagine anyone would want to try to talk to the SEC to launch their lending product because they would be afraid of getting a no with no explanation.
Well, Molly Jane Zuckerman, it's been a pleasure as always to talk to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Now, Ether is the world's second largest cryptocurrency, and last month, big changes were made to how payments are processed. Ethereum Improvement Proposal 1559 means that part of every transaction fee is now being burned, or, in simpler terms, removed from circulation forever. It's hoped this will help reduce the amount of Ether in circulation, and that this, in turn, could boost ETH prices. These changes could be important too. Now, while Bitcoin has a fixed supply of 21 million coins, no limit on ETH supply actually exists. So far, more than 250,000 ETH has been burned in about a month, and at times we've seen more than $2 million worth of ETH being burned in a single hour. And for the first time, we've seen the number of ETH that's being burned in a single day overtake the new ETH being created by miners. Well, joining me now to discuss this is David Myhall. He's a blockchain engineer who runs sites including cryptofees.info and ethburned.info. Hi, David. How are you?
Good. Good to be joining you today.
Great to have you with us. So, some people listening to this might react with a bit of alarm that more than $800 million in ETH has been burned so far. Why is the Ethereum network doing this?
Oh, there's a number of reasons that Ethereum kind of added this burn mechanism. And the original purpose of this was, the burn was really a side effect of this change. The original purpose of this mechanism was to make Ethereum easier to use, to make paying fees on Ethereum more predictable. So kind of before this EIP 1559 update was added to Ethereum, when you sent a transaction, you kind of had to like guess the price that you wanted to send your transaction at. There were all these tools. There were sites like ETH Gas Station and Gas Now that would kind of tell you like what everybody else is paying for their transaction. So you would kind of look at that and go, okay, everybody else is paying X to send their transaction. You know, maybe I'm okay kind of paying what everybody else is paying, or if I want to get my transaction really quickly, that means I need to like pay a little bit more than what everybody else is paying. But you might be able to guess kind of one of the issues. If everybody's trying to pay more than what everybody else is paying, that's just going to kind of push the fees up and up and up. If you pay a little bit less, then you're going to get stuck. A lot of people who've used Ethereum might have dealt with the issue of you send a transaction and it gets stuck. Like you didn't pay enough gas and now it's just kind of like sitting there and you have to figure out how to like change your gas price or cancel it. It's not a good experience. So the purpose of this update was just to make Ethereum easier to use.
I do just want to talk about transaction fees for a second, David, because it was hoped this Ethereum improvement proposal that now causes ETH to be burned would help reduce the cost of using the Ethereum network or make it more predictable. Have we really seen much of an improvement so far?
In predictability? I think we have. It might not... I'm not sure if it quite hit everyone's expectations that it's become way easier. But there are some charts out there where you can look at the transaction fees before and after 1559. And before, it kind of looks like this really noisy chart, lines going up and down and up and down and up and down. And after, it's like kind of a much more smoothed out curve. The other reason that people might not have noticed this like user experience improvement is that a lot of wallets kind of had to update to get the real user experience improvement. It took a while for like, you know, for say MetaMask to include that update. I use a hardware wallet. Most hardware wallets still don't support it yet. So not everybody might be getting those like user experience updates, but they're definitely there. And the numbers show that I think it has improved. I saw Hayden Adams, I think this was Hayden Adams, the CEO of Uniswap Labs, tweeted that the amount of like failed Uniswap transactions decreased significantly after this update. So that probably implies, you know, people aren't sending these like stuck transactions quite as much as they used to be. So I think that's a pretty good indicator that this probably has helped.
Yeah, and the website you've created, ethburn.info, is pretty mesmerizing to watch because you can actually see in real time the ETH that's being burned per block. And I was looking at Tuesday's data. Obviously, Tuesday was when the crypto markets took a bit of a bath. And it's just interesting to see that there were these big spikes in the amount of ETH being burned per block. And like your website says, the more Ethereum is used, the more ETH is burned.
Yeah, it's really interesting to watch kind of the network respond in real time. And it's cool. Of course, you know, this big spike came when the crypto prices started crashing. You know, when crypto prices crash, a lot of people might be in leveraged positions. They need to exit, or they need to move some assets into an exchange. So everybody's really rushing to use the network as much as possible. But the cool thing about this update is it means, you know, even when the prices are crashing, people are using the network, that's going to have a decreasing pressure on the Ethereum supply. So I think I saw some people saying, you know, even when the prices are crashing, it's still good for Ethereum.
And analysts, some analysts anyway, are setting targets of $5,000 or $10,000 for ETH, and its price has more than quadrupled so far this year. If we're looking at the coming year, what impact will burning all of this ETH potentially have on prices, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, of course, nobody can really know, you know, whether the price is going to go up or down. But it reminds me of the discussion around Bitcoin halvenings. You know, Bitcoin had their big halvening last year, kind of in the first half of 2020, and there was a big debate over, is the halvening priced in or not? You know, halvings are very predictable. Since kind of the first day Bitcoin was live, you could, you know, basically put a date on a calendar and go, on this date, the amount of supply issued by Bitcoin is going to decrease. So theoretically, anyone who's doing a price analysis should be able to price that in. But, you know, the halvening happened and the bull market really kicked off shortly after. You know, it's still open for interpretation whether the halvening caused it or not. But, you know, it seems that there might have been that supply shock. Now, with Ethereum, it's interesting because some of these updates are giving similar supply shocks to Ethereum. But, of course, these are kind of updates to the protocol. These aren't quite as predictable. So when 1559 was implemented and this burn was added, you know, I think we've seen around, maybe don't quote me on this, but I think we've seen around a 50% decrease in the net issuance of Ether. So that's a lot of Ether that in the past was being mined by miners and maybe sold on the market to pay for the electricity. That Ether is now being just removed from existence. And then in you know, in a few months, kind of maybe probably early 2022, when the proof of stake merge happens, that's also going to be a massive decrease in Ether issuance. And if you combine that that decrease in issuance of the proof of stake merge, combined with this ETH burned, it seems very likely that we're going to see kind of the maximum supply of ETH that'll ever exist, and just the amount of ETH will start decreasing. And so that's really interesting because, you know, remember, Bitcoin's not going to hit its maximum amount of its maximum supply until 2140, after a lot of us might not be here anymore. And Ethereum could hit that in the next 6 months.
And I just wanted to talk about the impact on miners as well, because they're no longer receiving transaction fees as a reward for validating blocks and adding them to the blockchain. How are they feeling about this?
Yeah, so there was a bit of like controversy leading up to this update that some miners were pushing back against it because it's effectively a little bit of a pay cut for them. You know, before a lot of the transaction fees were going to miners, and transaction fees have been so high that this started to become a significant part of their revenue. And of course, this update basically says, no, we're not going to give you those fees anymore. Instead, we're just going to burn. We're going to destroy those fees. So some miners weren't all that happy about that. But, you know, one thing is miners are paid in ETH. And so even if the amount of ETH they're receiving goes down, if the value of that ETH goes up, they could still have an increase in revenue denominated in US dollars. And of course, we've seen ETH rising pretty high in the past, just in the past month. So I don't have the exact numbers, but I imagine even with this decreasing, even with them not receiving their fees anymore, they probably still are making more money than they were before. And the other thing I would add is that if you look at the hash rate on Ethereum, it's continuing to rise. So, you know, any people who are saying, oh, you know, miners aren't going to like this and the miners are all going to leave, like, the numbers just don't support that. There's more miner power coming online to Ethereum every day.
You make a really good point there because, of course, in 2009, the block reward for Bitcoin, a miner would receive 50 Bitcoin for every block that they validated. And that would have been worth, you know, potentially cents. Whereas now the block reward is 6.25 Bitcoin. And yet we're in a situation where that is a substantial amount of money. So although they might be getting
less crypto. If the prices do rise, like you say, in dollar terms, it is a pay increase.
Yeah, I think it's very comparable to kind of these Bitcoin halvenings. You know, when Bitcoin halvings, miners receive less Bitcoin. But of course, people kind of expect the price of Bitcoin to go up. And that's part of the game they're playing. Now, of course, these updates to Ethereum may not be quite as predictable. But, you know, I still think it's part of the game. And it's a net positive for anyone who's invested in the ecosystem. So when miners were talking about this, I think the smaller miners who might be really invested in Ethereum, they were generally pretty happy about it. And the miners who were maybe just mining and selling, that they were just kind of viewing it as a job, maybe they were the ones who were a little more upset about it being like a pay cut in terms of the amount of ETH they receive.
And you touched on this before, David, about Ethereum 2 and what's going to be happening and when. How are the timings for Ethereum 2 currently looking? Are we confident that there aren't going to be any further delays?
The time for Ethereum 2, there haven't been any major announcements recently. I think EIP 1559 shipping basically on time is a good it's a good show that the Ethereum core developers can kind of do big updates, that they can still do big changes to the protocol and ship them relatively on time. There are still a few people that are well, first I'll say when you say ETH2, I assume this is like the proof of stake merge. That's what a lot of people refer to as, when is ETH2 coming? Because the proof of stake chain has already been live for about 9 months, but the next big step is combining that chain with the existing, you know, proof of work chain that everybody uses. Some people, I think, are still optimistic that we can do it before the end of the year. I'm going to be a little more conservative and say, I think first or second quarter of 2022 is probably when that will happen. But, you know, it's open to interpretation, but the important thing is that, you know, there's not really any like difficult problems to solve on that merge front. You know, the proof of stake chain is live. It's been live for 9 months and it's run remarkably well. And so just kind of switching one consensus algorithm for the other, it's not that complicated of a change. The important thing is just, you know, we have this like multi-billion dollar economy that's running on proof of work. So, you know, as we're switching it over, we need to be really, really careful that there's no bugs, that that we do everything carefully and don't cause any disruption to this internet economy that's running at light speed.
David Myhall, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you so much. It's been fun to join and chat about this. So take care.
The RMB star Akon hit headlines around the world when he announced plans to build a futuristic city in the West African country of Senegal back in 2018. Akon City has been billed as a modern metropolis filled with twisting skyscrapers, inspired by the fictional kingdom of Wakanda from Marvel's comic books. As well as being powered by renewable energy, Akon's vision is that the smart city will be 100% crypto-based, with residents and visitors using a specially created cryptocurrency called Akoin. Well, it sounds intriguing, but how have things been going with the project? Well, joining me now is Emmett Livingston. He's the West Africa correspondent for Agence France-Presse. That's the AFP news agency. Hi, Emmett. How are you?
Very well, thanks. How are you doing, Connor?
Very well, thank you. And thank you very much for joining us. So, 1 year ago, Akon laid the first ceremonial stone of this amazing new futuristic city that he wanted to build. What's happened since then?
Well, to put it briefly, nothing at all has happened since then. At least nothing physical has been built. So you can go to the fields where the first stone was laid and it's still just an empty field. Mm-hmm. However, if you talk to the building company, they will say that they have been in contact with contractors and suppliers, and they give the impression of machinations happening behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. But on the ground, zero.
Yeah, I mean, there was one particularly telling line in the report that you did for AFP, and it said that there was there'd been a small placard on top of this ceremonial stone that had been toppled off.
Yeah, that's right. It's symbolic, isn't it? It was kind of just kind of sitting kind of ignominiously in the ground. But just to give a bit of context on the field, it really is just a large empty field. And the stone itself is kind of just a cube sitting literally at the end of a dirt track in a field.
And how are locals feeling about this? Are they still hopeful that this is going to go ahead?
The impression that I got was that almost everyone that we spoke to on the ground was hopeful about the project. It's an area that doesn't have many jobs. There's a lot of young people who are looking for work. And no one, I mean, everyone just kind of wanted to get a job. And they were seeing this as an opportunity to hopefully stay where they are and not have to leave, kind mm-hmm. of thing. There was reticence among some people. I didn't meet many people who were very clear on what the project was. Mm-hmm. I met a lot of people who wanted more details. And of course, there were some people who were more openly critical. Mm-hmm. So that was the kind of the situation on the ground. It was difficult to speak to people, so I don't have a very accurate picture on what everyone in the village thinks. Mm-hmm. And I tended to speak more to people who were in a leadership position.
Do we know anything about why construction has been delayed? Is this a COVID-related thing, or is something else going on, do you think?
So I asked the question of several of the big players who were involved in the project, and none of them mentioned COVID as a reason. And in fact, they launched the project in September 2020, so this was already in the middle of the pandemic.
Yes.
So I don't know directly whether COVID would be a reason, but of course it wouldn't surprise me if there were supply delays and so on because of COVID. But mm-hmm. KE International, which is the construction firm, which is supposed to be doing the building, intimated that there were problems with contractors and suppliers and that negotiations were ongoing, but they didn't want to go into detail. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult to say. People in the village assumed that it was because of COVID. But one of the interesting things is that we spoke to the deputy mayor of the commune. So the commune is the larger region, which includes 24 villages. Mm-hmm. And he is from Mbodien. He started saying that it was because of COVID, that mm-hmm. the delays were because of COVID. But it transpired that he actually hadn't been in contact with anyone from the project almost since the get-go, so since last year. So he was speculating that it was because of COVID. He didn't actually know. And then when we pressed him, he admitted that he didn't know firsthand why there were delays.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were some ambitious milestones set for this project, you know, a hospital, a school, shopping mall, homes, a police station are supposed to be built by 2023. The whole city is meant to be done by 2030. Does it seem unlikely now that these targets will be met? And is there any sign of when or if construction will begin?
Look, how should I put this? I am not supposed to offer my own personal opinion mm-hmm. as a reporter. I mean, I think it's safe to say that the targets are ambitious. Senegal is also known as a place where big infrastructure projects take time.
Akon City's planned cost is $6 billion. Where's this money coming from? And given the fact that Senegal's overall budget last year was $7.5 billion, is it fair to say that the country's got quite a bit riding on this?
Well, you've asked the golden question to which everybody who's taken an interest in this wants to know the answers. $6 billion for a country like Senegal is a huge, huge amount of money. And to put it frankly, who is funding this, it's not at all clear. The only direct answer that I have been able to get and other journalists have been able to get is that there's a Kenyan businessman who is the main investor behind this. So far, $4 billion has been put up by investors, and whether that Kenyan investor is putting up all $4 billion or a part of the $4 billion and who's making up the shortfall, it's absolutely not clear. Mm-hmm. And then to your second question, whether Senegal has a lot riding on this, I think that answer depends on how much you believe the promises that have been made about this project. So the promises have been that it will make Senegal a leader in audiovisual technology, that it will galvanize tourism from North America. Now, if you believe that, then I think that you could make an argument that, yes, Senegal would benefit hugely. On the other hand, I haven't met many people who believe the promises to that extent, shall I say. Mm-hmm. And I tried to speak to the government about this. They wouldn't speak to me on the record. I don't get the impression that people think this is kind of a make or break issue for the country. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because it depends on whether you believe that it's going to revolutionize industry and so on, as they've promised. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I'm not sure that's the case. The impression I got was that most people are simply hoping to get jobs. People who don't have jobs who want regular employment, and that's their main motivation.
Emmett Livingston, West Africa correspondent for the AFP News Agency. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Connor. Pleasure.
And that is it for this week's Coin Market Recap. I'm Connor Sefton, and thank you very much for listening. Please, 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 please do follow our podcast. And don't forget that we also have a daily newsletter that delivers all of the top stories to your inbox. You can also head to coinmarketcap.com/Alexandria for easy to understand features on how crypto works. And if you've got any feedback or questions about what we've discussed on the show, our email is podcast@coinmarketcap.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.